What you and I are about to hear is a soul-searching account of how one man dedicated his life to creating an extraordinary London institution. The setting is London's Notting Hill, but this is Notting Hill way before Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts arrived on the scene. It's 1985. We're at 119 Kensington Church Street on the corner of Campden Street and a very ordinary run-of-the-mill pub called the Churchill. This is the story of how Gerry O'Brien, through a mantra of people first, teamwork, tenacity, and ceaseless improvement, turned that very ordinary pub into something extraordinary. He shares his innermost memories, starting with his childhood in Ireland, coming to London, building his career, his mentors, his influences, and exactly how he created a world-renowned and extraordinary pub. And also, he shares the poignant memories of the years after he left the Churchill. We'll hear laughter.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Lots of laughter.
Yeah.
A senior member of the royal family gets a name drop, and we'll be finding out why Bob Geldof got ratty. We also find out how Gerry overcame the bumps in the road of business, and we hear his regrets, his deep regrets, his dark periods, and the despair of a man who thought suicide was a better option to experience in the void left after his tenure ended at his beloved Churchill Arms.
Come on in, Gerry. You come and confess it all.
I'm in a podcast studio in Shoreditch, East London, and 73-year-old Gerard Daniel O'Brien, better known as Gerry, a sharp-witted Irishman with more energy than Michael Flatley in the final crescendo of River Dance, has just arrived.
It's a lovely morning, isn't it?
Oh, beautiful.
It's got the sun is shining out there. It's fantastic.
Hello there.
We started with a sound check.
How are you? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Oh, that's perfect. Sorry.
I tell you what, just relax.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
It's not, I appreciate it. We have to have.
Because we're going to talk about.
We have to have.
You know, a very important thing.
Yeah.
You know, you and the Churchill and. Everything like, so just relax.
Yeah, that's true. It's true, Elton. Yeah. It's the only way to do it, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Elton, are we going to go back to my home days, young days, what I can remember first?
Yeah.
Or are we going to start?
Yeah, so I think if we go back.
The red light was on, we were recording. But Gerry was clearly a little uneasy, what with the microphone just a few inches away from his nose. So to ease him in, I asked him how his journey from Ireland was.
Oh, marvellous, Elton. I got up at 5 o'clock yesterday morning. I got the first flight from Shannon because I wanted to be over early morning. Lovely, lovely flight, Elton. And I got the cab from Heathrow into Kensington High Street, had my breakfast there.
Roughly half an hour later, he finished telling me about his journey.
Went into Lloyds Bank and got a bit of money out because didn't get too much sterling at home. They didn't have it, you know. So then up to my hotel and then had a few hours nap.
He was ready, more relaxed. He was now oblivious to the microphone, but in his face, there was definitely a slight look of trepidation. Don't let that laughter fool us. So, a final check. He was happy to proceed. I asked him about his childhood. Make a mental note of his fondness for flowers, plants, trees and butterflies. You'll hear these words a lot. They are a constant in his life.
We grew up in that lovely house called the Glebe House, you know, in the parish of Ogonallow in Clare, you know. And we had, 18 acres of land as well, you know. But the house was beautiful. And then there are my memories, where my memories start of. The location was lovely. We were looking down right onto the River Shannon. Beautiful spot from the house, from the windows, from the front of the house, looking right down through all the fields and all that. And there was the River Shannon just below us there. And then across from there was all the Tipperary hills and that, you know. It was beautiful. Looked for a view from there, but just the surrounds at the Glebe, the lovely avenue into the house from the road, lovely piers and a gate and walls outside and off the road, and then you walked in the avenue, kind of a curve in along, and then there was the lovely Glebe house, you know. God, it's a beautiful standing basement as well, and up and up and up, and then all the ivy growing up each side, and it was magnificent, and the trees. That's what I remember, Elton, was the trees, massive trees growing around, all around. Huge beech trees, you know, oak trees, chestnuts, And I know I used to, and then of course we had lovely rhododendrons in along, and holly trees in along both sides of the avenue. And the rhododendron bushes, they grew and grew and grew as well. And we had roses on the front of the house as well, with the ivy and all growing up. And then we went on in along a lovely avenue, and then you went right around in the back into the kind of a lovely courtyard at the back of the house, you know. And there was all cobblestones. The yard was all cobblestones. And I remember then, because when I was a young lad, you know, looking at the trees, I used to stand underneath the trees and looking up at them. The big limbs and the branches, they were like trees on their own, growing out from, and looking right up. And I used to be out. And then we had this huge, lovely area full of daffodils in the spring. I don't know how many bundles, rows and rows and rows of daffodils. And there was such a sight.
Jerry was just 2 days old when his father died. Was this something that made his bond with his mother so strong? He clearly showed deep affection for her.
The yard at the back was lovely. But of course, every spring, my mother and myself, we used to be on our knees with knives, taking up any moss or grass that used to grow up in between the cobblestones, you know. And it was a huge, oh God, it was a, oh, knuckles, knees. But it was a big job, which was beautiful and just done, you know. And we had a lovely river. That was the front. And we had a lovely drooping ash. There's, you know, the lovely drooping ashes, the way they grow down. Like they, there's another type of tree as well, similar. But we had a lovely one of them in the front. And to see that, and we had a swing off of it. We had a swing, and we used to be playing swings on that. And my neighbours, my own age, or a couple of lovely lads who were, I was great friends with at school, they used to come over, and we used to go fishing on summer Sundays and that, you know, on the river. We'd start at one end, and we'd work our way all the way up along the fields. We used to come back home with lovely trout, small trout. I don't know what we did with them. My mother wasn't too keen on cooking them, but they were too small. But it was, you know, the feeling you'd get from catching with your hands. We were catching fish with our hands, imagine. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable indeed. School gets a fleeting mention now, but Jerry focuses more on his local childhood shop. Ireland's village shops are more than just shops to buy bread or beans or potatoes or butter. They're also places you can stop for a pint of Guinness and stay for the crack of conversation. This shop, and Mrs. Wallace, the shopkeeper, planted a seed in Jerry's mind, as he shares with us now.
School then was lovely as well, of course, the primary school. And then just below the school then was a shop, our local shop, we called it, you know. And it was about 10 minutes walk altogether from the house down to the school, then down to the shop. That's where I used to go to shop for my mother, you know, whatever she needed when I was able to get going that way and so on. And I had my first bicycle. I remember my first bicycle. And I was training how to cycle in and out the avenue of the house, you know, to get up on the room. And when I got going then, couldn't stop me. Going down to the shop to get messages from my mother, you know. I remember the shop was for everything. They had everything you wanted, all local people and all the people that lived in the area, all types of groceries. But there was and then they had a bar at the same counter. Half the counter was groceries, half the counter was a bar higher up, and they'd be serving their pints over to the farmers and then just the local people, like, you know. And I used to, and it was there that I always remember. I used to be looking at the counter, my hands on the counter, reaching up to the counter, looking at people working behind there. It was a lovely woman that owned the place. She was Mrs. Wallace. Mrs. Wallace was her place. And she was kind of quite elderly now when I was that age. And she'd be stooped a little bit behind the counter and you're watching her serve. But I used to be looking down to the end of the bar at the counter and watch them pouring their pints from the wooden barrels behind the counter. They were pouring Guinness, and you'd see them scooping off the head to get the set until it settled properly so they had a full pint. I used to be fascinated watching them do that. And the farmers there all chattering away about their life and so on. And I used to always say, God, I remember well, he used to, and I never thought it would happen, but I remember saying to myself and thinking several times in those trips into the shop, wouldn't I love to be behind a counter? You know, and later on that was something that did happen, you know. But I remember that's where that, whatever it was, I just thought, I'd love to be doing that. I'd love to be serving. I'd love to be serving those drinks. I'd love to be doing that. And little did I know, Elton, that was going to happen, you know. The scenery was beautiful there, and the air. That's what I miss about it, the air. You know, what I remember most is like in spring, summer. You know, then summertime, of course, all the fields were all full of farmers saving their hay, you know, cutting their hay in the summertime. And the smells, oh, God. And then around the glebe as well, where, you know, you'd notice all the thing, the birds, you know, and so on, nesting and all that type of thing. We had lots of them, crows on the trees, the noise. And then butterflies, summertime. Oh, I used to be following them around. And I remember that became a little bit of a thing on, for me years later as well, butterfly collecting and that. But I remember I used to be trying to catch them, putting them in matchboxes and stuff like that in summertime, you know.
And Jerry shared his memories of his local church. The giving and taking of wine at communion, the way the priest served the congregation clearly stuck with him. The theatre of it all intrigued him.
And then, of course, the church was only another 10 minutes away, and I became an altar boy for a few years, you know, as everyone does. I think a young days growing up, your time comes, you were trained to be an altar boy. So that was something I always remember, you know. But I used to love being an altar boy. I used to love serving. Here we are again, serving. Isn't it funny that word comes into it again, doesn't it, you know?
His voice just reinforces his fondness for this period, the first 15 years of his life, and that spark in his eyes says Jerry experienced a really lovely and happy childhood, packed full of simply, truly wonderful memories. But things were about to change. After this break, Jerry's mum shares news that will ultimately propel Jerry from childhood to manhood.
The narrator of this podcast, Elton Mooner, is a master practitioner in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. He was trained by Toby and Kate McCartney. If you would like to understand how NLP techniques can help reframe thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors that can help you or you to help others achieve personal and professional goals, Toby and Kate have a website, tobyandkatemccartney.com. tobyandkatemccartney.com.
Jerry's country upbringing, the shop, the church, the nature, had planted seeds in his young mind for what he may be doing in later life. But changes were afoot for Jerry. His mother sits him down and breaks the news that Glebe House has been sold and they're moving to the town of Ennis, where Jerry's mother originally hailed from.
So back to Ennis with my mother, sort out. And then I got a little job at Shannon Airport in the industrial estate in a factory. It was employing a lot of people, so for about a year, which was a silly old job, really. It was just stocking up all the bays, they were an electronic firm that were working there, that were running that particular place, and all types of radios and TVs that were being made there. So I was going around stocking up all the shelves with the people that were working on the lines, if we call it like that. But I got into a football team then. They were playing soccer in this factory. So I got into the soccer team, and I was quite good at soccer. I loved it. So it was just like I had nothing in mind for what to do, sort of thing. But I remember thinking one day, God, where am I doing? I'm playing soccer more than I'm doing anything. But the main thing was that I was bringing a wage back to my mother. And I used to come back on a Friday after I'd been paid. My wage envelope, I would never open it. I handed it to Mum, you know. Sorry, Mother. She was renting. I don't think she got a lot of money from the old house and farm. Because them years, at that time, property, the value was nothing like it would be today, so say for instance. So she got a certain amount of money, but when you think of what we had, 17 acres of land, the location, and the house, my God, it would be worth a million today, maybe, you know, when you think of it. But there we are, that was them times. But anyway, I was so happy to give that envelope to Mam every week. And, you know, I never opened it because... you know, I knew she needed it, you know, and I had enough. I was working. I was out meeting people and so on.
So Jerry was looking after his beloved mother, as he did throughout his life. But his factory job just wasn't ticking the boxes of things he valued. As he explains here, Jerry had some holiday left at the factory and went off to visit his sister in the Big Smoke, London. It wasn't just the Aer Lingus jet that was about to take off. Things were just about to take off for Jerry too.
Then one day I remember my sister was in London then, work in nursing. She had gone away to children's nursing in Dublin for a few years. Then she went on to London. Then she was over and back on holidays. And one day she said, I had my holiday from the factory. And I remember she was back and she said, do you want to come over with me? She said, you have a week and a half or something left. But she was going back after her holiday. And I said, I will. I said, love God, London. Oh, I thought, my God, London, my God, you know, I think just you just couldn't get your head around it. But of course, my sister was in Kilburn, so I stayed with her in the flat. And I thought, God, I said, would I find a job over here? Because I was, you know, I had no career going. I had nothing going. At 17, you begin to wonder, what are you going to do with yourself, you know? Anyway, my sister said to me, I said about this bar. I said, I'd love to be behind working a bar. She said, right. She said, I will look up and see what might be there. So she got the Irish Post, which is still being published today, and they had some ads. And she said to me, this ad looks very good. She said, it's an ad in Marylebone for a live-in barman's job, a trainee barman's job in Marylebone. And I said, right. So of course I didn't know where I was.
So Jerry and his sister headed to the tube station, off to find the Prince Regent.
So she took me on. We got out in Marylebone High Street. And we were looking, where's this Prince Regent pub in Marylebone High Street? So we were, and then we looked up. I remember the building, the Prince Regent, looked really stood out. And she said, oh, it must be, I think that's it. I remember she saying, it looks a lovely building. So I went in anyway. And she waited outside, I think, for me, sat outside somewhere. So that's where I ended up, how I came to London and how I came to go to the Prince Regent in Marylebone. Never had been behind a counter in my life, Elton, you know, never did it. But and that was in my head. I would have something I wanted to do, loved to do. So I met Mr. Tierney.
Landlord Michael Tierney, Mr. Tierney to you and I, was to play an important role in Jerry's life then as a mentor, but he will also play an important role some years later.
And it was a lovely place, the Prince Regent. I remember going in and looking, God, the pub was, it wasn't just a pub, it was the place looked lovely inside.
As Jerry told his story, he was getting more and more animated, almost agitated. He was so keen and so enthusiastic to tell us his story.
There were big, big blackamoors on the counter, and the decor was beautiful, and the lovely restaurant to the right. And you could see the chef behind the counter of the restaurant. Lovely tall man, his hat and whites. And I thought, God, I felt this is somewhere special. And then Mr. Tierney came to me anyway and took me into his office. And I can't remember a lot of what happened, but I remember saying to him, I think a little bit of what I'm saying now about how I had this thing about working behind the counter. I had that thing from early days watching the people in the shop back at home. And I said, I just love to serve. I'd love to serve people. I'd love to meet people. I'd love to serve people. And I think that's what I said. And to whatever it was anyway, he rang me the following day and he said, I will offer you, and I'll take you in, and I'll offer you a trainee barman's job. He said, you have your accommodation, you will have your accommodation here, you know. So a couple of days later, I arrived and he showed me my room upstairs, and that's where my life behind bars started, you know.
And he took to it like a duck to water. Jerry was being taught his trade personally by seasoned, highly professional and highly respected Mr. Tierney. And listen to Jerry's tone of voice here. It clearly gives away the respect he had for Mr. Tierney.
Mr. Tierney, oh my God, the Prince Regent. It was like the cream of pubs. That's the way he had it. He was dressed immaculate every day with his rose, his tie, suit, and the way he looked after customers. The way he was bowing to them nearly as they came into the pub, and there were the people were there were. We had the Royal Academy of Music in Marylebone Road. We had Harley Street, just up, a small bit up there. And they were all that type of customer. He was very special and we attracted and we wanted to keep in.
As we hear more from Jerry, we'll hear respect is something he values greatly, both showing respect to others and receiving respect.
And my God, serving those people. But they, I couldn't believe it, how the appreciation that I used to get from them. They all knew I was new. They all knew I was young. They all could see I was being trained to, and they would help you. They would like talk to you, the people, the customers, and they would give you back the appreciation. They made you feel so well.
And that strong work ethic and keenness to learn and get on was positively oozing from him.
I could not wait to get to know as much as I could how to serve. How to do it, I know my drinks and so on. And I wanted to serve them properly as well, you know, myself, because they were giving me back. So I was getting all this lovely feedback from people and warmth and everything, you know.
Jerry had found something special and he had made a decision. He was not going back to Ireland, but instead he was going to stay in the Big Smoke. He was staying in London. But how was his mother going to take the news?
I rang my mother. I'm not coming back. I said, my God. I don't know what she must have thought, but I think she was happy to know that my sister was there. So I'll go to my sister's for my day off and things like that, you know. And she knew that I had a job and I was sort of, I was being looked after. My mother, I think, was happy that that was the situation.
And things were going well at the Prince Regent. Jerry was enjoying himself. He was learning his trade. And remember that reference to more energy than Michael Flatley in the final crescendo of Riverdance?
At the Prince Regent, then I was moving on. I was really getting better and better. And I was flying around the bar and I was serving the people like mad. And I loved every second of it. But, you know, that people would come in and greet you and by your name and shake your hand. And then when they were going, leaving, they'd say goodbye, Jerry, and goodbye, Michael and Mr. Tierney. You know, Mr. Tierney, he was like, oh, my God, he was like, what? And we were all dressed in lovely uniform behind the bar. I mean, it was fantastic. The start that I got, you know, the whole thing that mattered was the people that came to the pub. And you could see the pub, the type of pub he had and the respect that people had for him. And that we got that respect from them, those people as well. And so therefore we tried to be as better every day at our job, really, to pay back something. And we had our home and we had our food and we had our uniform. Living in London, I mean, it was fantastic and a beautiful area, you know.
He was happy. And Jerry's mother was so pleased for him too. But that need to get on, to do better, to better himself, was about to call. Find out what happened after this short break.
Feature Design is a tiny little, big award-winning design and print agency for the hospitality sector. Yes, Feature Design, tiny and little, but award-winningly big. Find them on featuredesign.co.uk. Email studio@featuredesign.co.uk. It's 01227 743 730. Feature Design, the hospitality sector design and print agency. Oh, did I mention they're award winning? Yes, I did I? Sorry, just checking.
So Jerry spent several years with his mentor, Mr. Tierney. But that inbuilt drive caused him to say yes when this happened.
I got asked by another publican living in Marylebone and working at a pub in Marylebone to become his head barman. And, of course, wanting to get ahead and get on a bit more, I said yes. So, of course, I told Mr. Tierney that this other pub, it wasn't Vintage Inn pub either. It was a Charrington pub. But the governor used to come into the Prince Regent and maybe he was looking at me and spotting me working and so on. But he offered me a lovely head barman's job and a great big rise in salary as well, you know. So, of course, wanting to get on a bit, I didn't want to be just that barman. I wanted to be a bit more authority, a bit more, I don't know what it was, you know. And I took the job. And, of course, I had a head barman's job, God. And just only not far from the church or from the Prince Regent, which I don't think Mr. Tierney was happy about in a way, because a lot of people were coming from the Prince Regent down to this the pub called the Coachmaker's Arms in Marylebone Lane, and with a lovely restaurant upstairs. And this man's wife, Bobby, she was a wonderful cook, marvellous cook, and I used to love serving in the restaurant too for her, because I used to help both places, you know. And then I became cellar man as well. I was in charge of the cellar, of the stock, ordering stock, seeing the deliveries in. Oh, my God. And I was only 21, I suppose, or 22 then, you know. And then I think for 3 years, I think I spent with them. It was a beautiful time, though. But for me, it gave me a sense of, God, you know, I want to stay in this business.
Yes, he wanted to stay in the business. But that work ethic, that yearning for wanting to get on, moved from his unconscious brain bang smack into the middle of his conscious thinking with a vengeance.
I'd love to get my own place to run. I wanted that then badly. That was the next thing I was thinking about, you know.
But as he explains, would that actually even be possible?
And then, of course, the brewers, then here, well, they're very reluctant to give single people any pub, any place on their own. They always thought, I was taught this, they always thought there was too much responsibility for a single person. They always wanted couples, you know, married couples to make sure that both support one another and so on. But I was single, of course, I'd never got myself married or anything, so I was there anyway, and I was getting very frustrated, I remember, at one stage.
But then, remember Michael Tierney, Jerry's first employee, his mentor, the person who gave Jerry his first chance in London? Well, Mr. Tierney appeared in Jerry's life again, setting up things for Jerry's next chance.
And then one day, Mr. Tierney came to me and he said, Jerry, he said, there's a pub in our company, back again with Vintage Inns. He said, there's a pub coming up. He said, and I think, he said, you're the man for it. And he said, because of the way you worked for me, what you did for me, and the way you are, and the way you still are, he said, I'm still following the way you're keeping yourself and all that type of thing. I never dropped my standards, if you know what I mean, Elton, you know, from wanting to be spotless behind the bar, spotless in serving people properly, and just creating, well, I loved doing the job I was doing, you know, and to me it wasn't a job either, it was the people thing. I loved that thingy as well as knowing how to serve your drinks and knowing what the drinks were and so on and so on and so on. And so he said to me, Jerry, he said, I want you to go for interview for this pub. And so I went along for the interview. It was the pub called the Drayton Arms in South Kensington, you know. They said, we've know all about you from day one at the Prince Regent, and you're highly rated by Mr. Tierney, and we know why you left. You wanted to get on a little bit more, but we think this pub. So they wanted to know then what was my idea of running a pub and what made it interesting for me. So I told them what I was thinking, what I loved doing, what I'm doing, love looking after people, and wanted to get my own place. I really was screaming out for that. And it was, I said, everything, I only know this business and I love it. So I got the Drayton Arms. I was told then, the Drayton Arms is yours. You could run the Drayton Arms for us. And that was my first, I was 25 at that stage, you know. And of course then I was ringing my mother at home, telling her, I got my own pub to run. And the Drayton, she was thrilled. I had a rover as well a couple of times for that, you know. And then South Kensington was a lovely area as well, you know. The Drayton at that time then had been ran poorly for a while. It was, I went down to see it, and they told me to go and see it and come back to them and tell them what I thought was wrong. And I saw the people behind the bar. Oh God, at the Drayton, I remember I went in one Saturday afternoon, and they were all dressed casual and open, you know, just, oh, it was very, oh, you could see straight away.
Jerry's eyes darted to the right as he recalled the visual memories that told him this pub has potential.
But the building was beautiful. Outside, the building was a bit like that Harrods lovely look about it. A beautiful stonework up along. Oh, huge building. And they had a lovely room away from the pub, off the bar as well, and so on. And I thought, God, I could see myself in it straight away. So I said, Jerry, it's yours now. So whatever, a few days or weeks or a month later.
His next venture had his name above the door. And remember Jerry's childhood love of flowers and nature and butterflies? Well, his first pub was soon to become known as the Butterfly Pub.
But the Drayton was fabulous for me, Elton. I had 8 years at the Drayton, and I cleaned it up. Got the right staff in behind the counter, and we dressed in our uniforms, and it was magical, it was, you know. And it started going with a lovely room off the bar. And then, of course, they gave me the franchise of the food, Vintage Inns. I said, Jerry, we have a deal package. You have your salary and so on, and all stocks being well, you'll get a percentage of that, and then you can have the franchise of the food. Because they knew how much I loved serving food at the Coachmakers. I think they had been in there watching me working as well, you know. But I had the franchise of the food, and I thought, oh my God, that's another lovely part of, like, it was another lovely incentive, you know. I was like, oh God, wonderful. It gave me kind of a bit of freedom to say, look, this is your business, as well as the brewery, as well as the brewery business, you know, working for them. But you had your own kind of business. So, of course, I went at it. But I would have gone at it the same way anyway, really. But just it meant a little bit of extra something, you know. So, and then I got a lovely lady, a lovely Irish woman to cook for me upstairs. And we served wonderful food. And we served it all in that lovely room. And then the high ceiling pub, so all the walls were high, nothing on the walls. And I thought, I've had to decorate them walls with something. So, but there was a little bit of a history of years ago in that area, flowers were sown in that area that the pub was in the 1800s or something, for Queen Anne, flowers. And there was a little velvety cloth flower on the walls, just up a little bit all around the walls, just nothing. But then the rest of the place was all bare. And I thought, flowers. I went, you know, what goes with flowers? Butterflies. I thought of my youth when I was growing up on the glebe at home, following butterflies around in summertime, catching them. And I thought, butterflies. So I started a butterfly collection. And it became known as the Butterfly Pub. It became huge. And then I people were coming into me, talking and telling me things about butterflies. And I had to look up and read. It was, I had to get involved in this as well. But it was just a lovely sight to see, walk in, see the history of the area. It was flowers in that area for Queen Anne going back. Then the wallflowers were there from the brewery in cloth. But then the butterflies were there. And it created a beautiful scene as you walked in. It became known as the Butterfly Pub. And then we had a lovely room upstairs, a huge room, empty. And I mean, there were four floors or five in the Drayton. And the second floor was a huge empty room. And I cleaned it all up. We did lots of events there, you know. And we did a big the News of the World. Then they had a World News of the World darts competition going the whole country. We became, I had about 10 dart boards in there once for a weekend. And loads of dart teams playing. Oh, God. It became absolutely fantastic.
But there was a storm on the horizon. Jerry was working for a small pub company called Vintage Inns. Jerry loved working for them, and he respected them, and the respect from Vintage Inns to Jerry was reciprocal in equal measure. But then that warmth he loved became decidedly cold.
The company was changing because it was no longer Vintage Inns, because that man had died, John Hussey, and Charringtons were coming in, getting more involved in the way everything was run. And they came to me one day and they said, from, I think, a couple of months' time, everything is changing. You're not working for Vintage Inns as such. You're working for us now, Charrington's people, a couple of them. And they said, we're taking back your food. We're taking that back. This is ours now. And you're working for us now. And this was now after 8 years almost, you know. And I, oh, God, it was like a sudden bang. It hit me suddenly. What's going on? You know, the attitude was, I didn't feel that warmth coming from them after what I had done with the Drayton. I mean, really, it was booming. It was fabulous. And the area was lovely. And so that was it. I had no choice but to, no choice at the time, but to say, okay, you have the food. I've built the food up as well. But the way, the attitude was, you know, just, you're one of us now. And I felt something was not right about that, you know. And then around that time, I remember, that's when I met Mr. Williams from Fuller's. I remember they came into me one day at the Churchill, at the Drayton, and Mike Jones, they were two of them together, I remember, and they said who they were. And of course, I was very upset at that time, thinking about what was happening. After all, my whole career, my whole, like, what I had dreamt of having a pub of my own, if we call it that, and I had my lovely Drayton Arms, and there was something not right at that moment. You know, the attitude was from those people from the Charringtons, and I was feeling, and I think they knew, Fuller's knew what was going on, of course, and their business and their level. And I remember they saying to me, would you come out to interview at the brewery at Chiswick? And I said yes, but in my mind I was not clicking, I was not thinking straight. I couldn't get around to think that the Drayton was going to, I was going to, you know, this was something that was going to happen. So I never went to the, I never went out for interview. And they came back again, I think a week later, and said, you never came for interview. And I remember saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I'm so taken by what's going on, a bit kind of upset of what's happening. I forgot. I said, sorry. So I did go out the week after and I met Mr. Williams then.
But it was a memory of how Jerry masterfully turned a drama into a lasting positive experience that clearly stuck with Mr. Williams.
And I remember that day he said to me, Jerry, he said, I knew you the first day you came to London at the Prince Regent. Me and my wife used to go into the Prince Regent every Saturday night for dinner. And he said, Mr. Tierney introduced us to you. He said, this is a young lad from Ireland that's just come over. I'm starting him off. He said, we followed you. We knew all the time. We've known where you were. And I think it was one day at the Drayton, they had come in for lunch at the Drayton Arms, and I had a girl working outside on the floor. She had taken their order and put it on the thing, you know, but it had slipped off. So they were waiting for their food or for food down. Your lunchtime, the time is precious. And I kept serving away then, and the girl never, she was wrong, my lovely waitress girl, she never noticed that I wasn't, that their meals weren't coming, that I hadn't seen their order. And then I remember they came up to me at the counter, they said, whatever, sorry, we have to go now or something. We can't wait any longer for our food order. And they said, you dropped everything. You were just so upset that happened. You wonder, how did it happen? You looked at the board where you had your orders stuck, you know, food orders, and it had fallen off. It wasn't there. And you suddenly realised that's what happened. That's how we hadn't got our food. And they said, the way you reacted to that was unbelievable. We never forgot that either. And they said, because you were so upset, you stopped everything. And you gave us, you had our food out to us in 5 minutes. And they said, well, we waited another 5 minutes, another half an hour, just because of the way your attitude was, you know, the way you responded. He said, we've never forgotten that. And Mr. Williams said, there's two pubs coming up with us, he said.
And one of those pubs was in Kensington.
And of course, my eyes lit up. Kensington, the Churchill Arms in Kensington. And I thought, Kensington, because I had never gone up that way when I was in South Kensington before. I used to go back to the Marylebone from that area, from that way. Never came up to Notting Hill, you know. But I heard of the Churchill. Of course, you'd hear the name, you know, mentioned, like, you know, now and again. I had the name. And he said, and he could see that I suddenly was like, and I thought, Kensington. I thought, he said, will you go and see the both of them and so on. So I went to the one. I didn't like the one in Chiswick. I really didn't, whatever it was, but went to the Churchill. And I thought, oh, God. The Churchill, like, there was something about it. It felt like, God, this is a real pub. This is a pub. This is a real pub with that lovely wood everywhere. And the beams on the ceiling, you know. And I remember the screens on the counter, you know, those lovely screens that are on the counter. And then I remember going out the back and looking at that yard. And there was a big green door on the right of the going out to the pavement on the street, side street there. And it was just like empty space, you know. And I thought, God, there's something, look at that. But you know, at that time, I was still going. I was very upset about the Drayton because I had got my first pub and what was going? It was going up, 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 up. And we had that on the food, the lovely room, the butterfly room. We had been on TV with BBC. You know, the upstairs spare room, we were doing loads of events there. And it was something I never wanted to leave, you know. And because of the... just that change, the way it happened, and the attitude that I got from those people at Charrington's. And then, of course, I was still upset about that, you know, but there's something, the Churchill, there's something about it. So I went back to Mr. Williams and I said to him about the Churchill. I said, there's something about the Churchill that really got me. He said, we thought that. He said, what are you asking? What are you looking for? You know, as such. And I told him, I said, look, I said, there was something about it. But I said, I told him I was upset about the food franchise being taken away from me. I said, I told him that was happened, what was happening at the Drayton. And I said, I'm not making a lot of money from the food, but what I'm making is just what it gives me, that extra sense of my own business. And I said, and the more food we serve, the more drinks we'll serve. So I said, it's working both ways, isn't it? And I said, I'd love to spend a bit of money on decorating myself. So that's why I done with the Drayton, with the butterfly room and the publicity that got. And I said, that's what I had. And I said, that's what I'm upset about losing. Well, he said, look, he said, what if we give you the same deal as you have at the Drayton here at the Churchill? You have your own food operation. And he said, and then the salary. And but I said, there's one more thing. I said, Mr. Williams, that backyard, I said, I was looking out at it and I said, God, I said, it's an empty space. There has to be something done with that. I said, can we, you know, I said, he said, Jerry, he said, look, he said, see how you get on when you start. We'll give it a year there. And if you're happy, we're all happy. He said, we'll sit down and talk about that. So I got the Churchill Arms. That's how I got the Churchill Arms. Went back, gave my notice into Charrington's, or Vintage Inns. Well, there were Vintage Inns going towards Charrington's, of course. And then they came in to see, I gave my notice in, I was leaving, I was whatever. Then they came in to see me a week before I left. that sat down with me, somebody from China, the same chap from Shinington's that said about, oh, we're taking this off you, we're taking that off you, this is it. And he gave me a big financial deal to stay. He did. He gave me a lot of money to stay. He said, this is, you know, I said, I'm sorry. I said, the attitude wasn't right. I've got a lovely deal with Fuller's. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, it's too late now. You know, but he gave me a big money, I think, but I didn't like the attitude. It was like, it wasn't coming from there, I felt, you know. So I got the Churchill Arms. And my goodness me, what happened then? My God, you know. But I've never had the feeling that I have for the Churchill. I'd never had that feeling for any of them puppets before that. You know, I had a feeling, but not the feeling I have for the Churchill, you know. So it's a kind of a difficult one, you know what I mean? Anyway, so I'll get a little right down in a minute, yeah. You know, when I talk about the Churchill, it's not just like talking about the Drayton or the other pub or the Prince Regent. This is different, you know, so... because the Churchill, I don't know, there's something about it that I can't even explain, you know, that... Oh, God, yeah. So we're not talking yet now. Well, we might be, but I haven't started yet, you know. I'm just saying quietly, you know, yeah.
I tell him to take his time.
Okay. Yeah. So, okay, right.
Is that fear of change, or is it sadness from moving from his previous chapter? Or a mixture, I think, a mixture of both. At this point, we took a break. The irony is that Jerry went on to recall his wonderfully happy years at the Churchill with us and his huge achievements, but recalling them was clearly very emotional for him. So join us in part two of this podcast, Ordinary to Extraordinary, and he'll continue his story.
The narrator of this podcast, Elton Mooner, is a master practitioner in NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming. He was trained by Toby and Kate McCartney. If you would like to understand how NLP techniques can help reframe thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors that can help you or you to help others achieve personal and professional goals, Toby and Kate have a website, tobyandkatemccartney.com. tobyandkatemccartney.com.
In part one of Ordinary to Extraordinary, we heard the vivid and beautiful memories of Jerry's childhood, and how some of the influences from that childhood took centre stage in his first pub. He told me quietly after we pressed the stop recording button of part one that this is the first time he shared his feelings to this extent. So welcome back to part two, where we join Jerry as another chapter is about to begin. The Churchill years.
So, where was I? I had got the Churchill Arms. I was in Kensington. I suppose that meant an awful lot to me because I love Kensington. I love South Kensington. Notting Hill, very close, was a new area as well for me, you know. So didn't know how things were going to go. But was that something about the Churchill that got me, that was inside me to start me off, you know. And of course, I could see the things I wanted to do there. So I went to see it another time as well, another occasion. And I remember looking at the staff, the thing that was always the thing with me. It was the staff, the people behind the counter. What were they like? And so I felt that would always be where I would be when I was going to be there. That's where I was going to be, behind my counter. And were they the people that I would have liked to be with me behind my counter? And I thought, no. So I remember thinking, no, I've got to change that. And of course, I'm still suffering a little bit of loss from the Drayton Arms because it had become, it had grown into me a little bit as well for that length of time. But I was getting over that. It took me a little while to get that out of my kind of system. But the thing was that there was something, that how to explain it maybe sometimes about the Churchill and the feel you got when you were in there. The lovely old beams on the ceiling. I never forget looking up at them and thinking, look at that. I'd love to have a house like this with my front room or something with beams. And then I thought, God, I might be able to hang stuff there maybe. You never know. You know, I love collecting things anyway. And I remember people used to say to me, in the beginning, oh, you're up against it here. There's two great pubs in the area. You're really up against it here. You have a tough job on your hands. There's a great pub called the Windsor Castle up the top here. They sit up the top of the road here, the street, and they have a fabulous beer garden, very well known, famous. And there's another one called the, at the back of the pub, called the, oh, at the back, the church behind them, one of the side streets there with the, oh, still there today. I forget the name. Anyway, they're very well established pubs. And there were tenants actually in both of those pubs. So, you know, tenant puts more of his own thing into them and whatever. So I said, I remember saying to the people, well, I said, okay, but I said, there's two great pubs, but now might be three great pubs. And I said, we're going to work on that now. We'll see how it goes. But I said to myself, well, if there's two great pubs, that means that there's great people coming to those pubs in the area. So now we're not far from them. So hopefully we might get some of them in here as well. So I was thinking all of that, that I was, the potential was out there, but it was my job to get them in here and make sure that when they left, that they enjoyed their time in the pub. And when they were going, recognise them when they were leaving as much as when they were coming in.
That sparkle is back in his eye. Good. You can hear it, can't you? Well, Jerry went on to talk about the screens attached to the bar counter. Now, the history of bars divided by screens, they were often referred to as snob screens or snob rails. They date back to the Victorian era. They were meant to create a separation, a barrier between staff and their customers, the intention being to maintain a befitting level of decorum and prevent direct interaction between social classes. I've got a question for you. From what you know of Gerard Daniel O'Brien, do you think snob screens were something he loved or loathed? Yes, you're right. Loathed. The latter. He loathed them. Now, where did he put his hacksaw?
And, of course, the screens on the counter. Now, they were fascinating from the front, outside, looking in. But I remember thinking, God, I was behind. So when I got there, I was behind the counter. And I had the screens to the right, some in the middle were nice, but the one further up was all around the corner, all going around. And I thought, I can't see anyone. I can't see a customer. I was serving people. Like, I could see hands coming through the screens. And I was taking orders, like, you know, and giving money, giving their change back. Just like, and I can't see anyone properly. I couldn't see anyone coming in the door, which I thought was always fierce important. When the door opens, your eyes straight away look to that door. He was coming in. You might meet, get eye contact, or you, at least you know there's people coming in. And in front of all the doors, the three doors there, the screens are in the way, kind of thing. And I thought, God, you know, so it bothered me for a few weeks. And I remember one day then I said to myself, it's those screens from behind the bar. And I was there like, and I thought, I said, no, come on, I'm going to take this slot down. And I had an old hacksaw myself, and I remember cutting the screws under the counter, three of them, and all this big portion of screens, they all then came off. And then I suddenly thought, oh God, myself, what have I done? Because suddenly this all space opened up in front of me, and empty, and I thought, oh God. And for a minute I thought I'd done something really wrong. But I thought, no, I want to see my customers. I want to wave for them. I want to say goodbye when they're leaving, coming in, hello. I just love that, being that way. But anyway, I took him down the cellar. And I remember a few days later, I think it was Mr. Williams came into the pub. And so somebody must have rang or told him what I had done or something like that, maybe a regular customer or something. You know, I mean, we had a lot of lovely regulars. There were lovely regulars then, that loved the pub and so on, you know. And they must have told him or someone told him. And he came in and said, Jerry, what have you done? Like, you really give out to me, you know. He said, they are part of the pub. He said, they are part of the character. But I said, Mr. Williams, they are maybe from out there where you are. But I said, you step in here where I am. And I said, I can't see anyone. I said, you come in as a customer when they were there. I wouldn't know you were there. I can't see you. And I don't know. I said, all I'm looking at is hands coming through. It's like being at a football match. You're taking tickets going into the match, but you don't know who you're dealing with, like, you know. I said, I can't see my people. I can't see my customers. I said, there's a gap. We have the central ones. They're lovely. I said, I know they're in front of the door as well. So I said, when the door opens, I can still see people coming in, but at least I know it's only a couple, but they're lovely. And the ones at the right, I said, they're blocking off a little bit, but I can see the door. I can see that door over there. But I said, I can't see. I said, will you give me a couple of weeks? I said, please, would you give me a couple of weeks? I said, Mr. Williams, and if and I'll put them back. I promise you I'll put them back. But would you? He said, okay, he said. And he wasn't very happy. I knew he wasn't happy. So I kept him down the cellar, put him in the office below. And after a couple of weeks, I think more, he left me. So he came in one day. He was like, I didn't know what he was going to say. I thought he was going to tell me put them back, but he could see the effect that I the effect that had on me, that I was, this is where I want to get to. He said, okay, Jerry. He said, look. He said, we'll go along with you. He said, but he said, we want to take the screens away. So they took him to the back to the Fuller's anyway, and of course straight away, I had my outlet. I had my freedom to contact with people when they walked in the door, welcome them and so on, and chat and over the counter, and leaving when they were going away, leaving goodbye, thank you and all that. And of course that got me up and running.
Whilst many pubs will go for the rent-a-crowd approach of putting sport on the telly, Jerry was never this sort of landlord. He didn't go for piped music either. But he did provide music.
Music to TVs and all that. I never wanted any of that. I thought, hang on. That takes away from people chatting and talking. And the atmosphere is, no. I said, we are the music from behind the counter. Me and my team are the musicians here, you know. So I used to think that way, you know. And I could feel there was something going to happen.
And Jerry realised he wasn't just selling beer.
No, we changed his beers. I don't know, IPA. We just brought it in, salted, nothing more to it. But we chimed with Fuller's, my God, London Pride, ASB, Chizzy, especially London Pride. And then, of course, the name. I love the name London Pride, you know, and London. You know, we're London, my God, and Pride. I mean, that name, that word Pride, goes along, it covers lots of different things. You must, and I, of course, I used to love saying, or people would be looking at the pumps, you know, at ASB, and I said, oh, you must take pride. You know, I said, you must take pride. And I said, you know, with the pride of London, you must take pride. And I loved all that little gimmicky things, you know, and people used to love it, of course, that he put London Pride. What a lovely name, I think it was. And the two words, London and then pride. And it was pride in what you do, pride in how you work, pride in how you serve people, pride in your house. Pride in everything, and then we had the beer to go with it. I mean, oh, it was glorious, wasn't it though? That name, you know. And of course ESB used to make me laugh, because ESB in Ireland means electricity supply board. So when you get your light bill, it's ESB. And I saw it be a pint of electricity. I said, you know, where do you get your bill? I said, no, but I used to laugh at that. But that was quite, but it was London Pride though. I thought that was, and I still do, a fantastic name, isn't it?
He was selling Fuller's beers, and they were not just beers, they were Fuller's beers, brewed as they are to this day, just a few miles away from the Churchill.
We have something, not just a pub, we have something here, we have Fuller's, and all started to build a little story, not just a pub, not just another pub.
Jerry was finding his feet and settling in well. He found the Fuller's people to be his sort of people. He had London Pride and other Fuller's beers to pour. And Guinness, of course. Jerry sold over 1 million pints of Guinness when he was at the Churchill. He'll tell you about Guinness a little later on. But here's a little preview.
But the Guinness pump used to be completely clean twice a week, because I was always felt, well, look, I'm Irish, I'm from Clare, you know, I'm Irish. I have to sell a good pint of Guinness, and people would expect it from you.
Your professionally recorded message will be played here. You will be given script writing guidance, and to bring your ad to life, it can feature sound effects like this, or this, or this, or even this. Your message in there is.
So the whole vibe of the Churchill was changing, and it was going to change for the better, even more. When a cricket-loving regular called Robbie had a bright idea.
He said, Jerry, he said, I'm Robbie. My name is Robbie, he said. He said, I play cricket for a team nearby somewhere. But he said, I can see what's happening in the pub here. He said, I would love to have a cricket team, to start a cricket team here. And we'd make the Churchill our local. And I thought, God, you know, I know nothing about cricket. I said, Robbie, I don't know anything about cricket. I know a bit, but I said, not enough to, I can't get, how can I get involved? He said, look, Jerry, if we need a bit of support, like, we need a little bit of money to buy some bats and balls and kit or whatever. And he said, then I will form the team. He said, I will do this. And he said, we could call it the Churchill Arms cricket team and join the cricket league or something. I thought, God, fantastic. And suddenly we had our cricket team. And then all of a sudden we had maybe 15 to 20 fellows. And they began to join the league, cricket league, meet every Sunday and all their whites and everything and go off to play a match, come back in the evening. Sometimes, most of the time they were beaten in the beginning, but we were, it was a talking point, it was something, and they became locals. And I had suddenly this backing of this lovely group of blokes, you know, fellas, and then they'd bring their girlfriends with them.
And in typical Jerry going the extra mile style,
we had the kit got for them. Every Sunday they'd meet for tea at 9 o'clock. I had the kit washed and everything for them and ready in their bags. And they had their tea and meat, and they'd all go away and play and then come back in the evening time, afternoon, spend the rest of the night in the pub, you know.
And something else was happening. If you've not been to the Churchill, you really should. Feast your eyes on the wonderful, eclectic menagerie of stuff that Jerry has collected bit by bit, building another story, another reason to visit and stay, to visit and return again.
And then, of course, I would love collecting. I asked, could I collect a few things for the ceiling and that, you know, hanging a few bits up. And they said yes. I think Mr. John said yes. Mr. William said yes. But I didn't know what I was going to do. But look, I started collecting, of course, and all that became a talking point as well. Suddenly people were coming in to me and saying, looking around, you could see them looking around and talking, and they'd bring in bits to me sometimes. Say, Jerry, we found this in a flat. We've just moved into the area. We found this in a flat, somewhere, maybe a chamber pot or something. We'd love you to have it. And of course, they could come in then and see their gift hanging on the wall and point it out to their friends. And I used to always say, you can always have it back whenever you leave, if you ever leave the area, or if I ever leave, which I thought I never would. But anyway, it was all a lovely talking point and building an atmosphere, you know.
Ah, yes. And remember the opportunity Jerry spotted, the potential of converting the yard at the back of the pub into a conservatory?
Mr. Williams coming to me at the beginning of the second year, and he said, remember what we talked about the back? He said, yes. And he said, Jerry, he said, we will, what are your thoughts of it? And you know, them days we closed in the afternoon, I think, still. I think we did for a while, didn't we? From 3 till 5:30, was it, or something? And I remember, and I think there was a law at the time that you could serve tea and coffee and maybe food in the afternoon, or some type of, some not alcohol in the afternoon, I think. That was the case then, I think. And I said to Mr. Williams, my God, couldn't we serve some lovely snacks or something and coffees and teas in the afternoon, and to have it for that? Not thinking that the laws were going to change again and soon, and we could, you know, open up all the time. And so he said, Jerry, he said, we'll go for planning permission. And I thought, oh, well, it gave me such a massive lift that, because I was beginning to fall in love with the Churchill then at that time. But I felt a little bit confined to the pub just now. I thought there was another space for something, for our food and for decoration type of thing to go with that and to blend in. And I thought, my God.
So they went for planning permission. But
we failed the first time because some of the regulars, I think, that thought we were going to be turning over a music bar or what, we're open all night or whatever. So we met the residents then, and there was a residents association. So I got to know them. We met them there. They came to see me at the Churchill and they heard from me. And then suddenly decided, oh, we were sorry, we did object, but we were not sure what your plans were. And from then I got to know the residents a bit more. That many of them anyway, and then taught them my plans, and they were all over the place. So I said, we'll be inviting you all in for tea and coffee in the afternoon for an hour or two in the afternoon. They'd be lovely to sit in the conservatory, which I thought we were going to have, like, and I'm thinking in my mind, what would I do with conservatory plants, decoration-wise, to make it another experience, you know, rather away from the pub. And so we got planning permission shortly after that, and then, oh, I'll never forget it, the day the lads, they started, they were knocking, took the door away from the street, that big old green door that was leading out to the side street, and knocked the walls down there. No, I'll never forget that morning. And you know what? I had my mother over. She came over, yeah. And I was telling her what was going to happen, you know, well, what we were hoping, well, but what was just happening. And I never forget that. She passed away a few months later, you know. So, but she saw that, you know. I wish you had seen the rest of the story.
We paused for Jerry to gather his thoughts. He was ready to carry on, and he continues the story. The conservatory is now open. Now, you've heard the phrase cloud nine. Well, that was how Jerry was feeling. But listen, Cloud Nine wasn't big enough for him.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I remember, I don't know, I was on Cloud 99. I think, I mean, because I thought, I knew there was something could happen again, you know, and it was lovely. So, sorry, it's very emotional because it was such a lovely time. And I was so lucky to have, you know, to have fallen into that place as well. You know, I could have been offered any pub or maybe taken another pub and it wouldn't have anything to offer much except just the pub and do your job and that. But I wouldn't have been happy with that. I always wanted that bit extra something to happen, you know, to be involved with. And look how lucky I was, you know. And I always thought of that. I've never forgotten that. And then the more and more we went along, as I say, got to know Fuller's more and people and the respect I was getting from the brewery.
There's that word again.
So we were changing the Churchill. The Churchill was beginning to change at that time. We were getting rid of a lot of undesirable people that were coming in there. I had to do that. I had to, in a nice way. And, you know, I had my way of saying to them, sorry, we have to part company or whatever we had to. Because if I allowed them to stay there, they would have stopped better people coming to the pub. They would have stopped the pub from growing. They would have stopped everything from growing, really. We would have been just at a level that we'd never get away from. And I had to change that. And people could see that. Then they were coming in bit by bit. More people coming in, they're saying, well, we're drinking the other pubs, we drink here, we like the way you're running the pub, you know. Lovely elderly people at that stage as well. And I thought, my God, this is happening. There's something going on. I had my butterfly collection from the Drayton in storage. I got them to the Churchill. I never forget the first day I started putting them up all along the walls. And then I started hanging plants and began to become, and then people were coming out to look at it.
So with the support of Fuller's, Jerry had magicked up some more space and people loved the conservatory. Drinks laws, they'd changed so people would be able to drink in the afternoon. But what about the food?
But of course, food-wise wasn't great at the time because we had a lovely lunchtime menu going. But at night, I always thought, God, we need to have a different menu. We need to have a different menu for nighttime because that's lunchtime menu. We have to have something. What can I do?
Something very unusual was about to happen. Could Thai food in a great British pub actually be a thing? Jerry takes up the story.
One day, would you believe it or not, I met the Thai chef, Ben, and he told me where he was working down in the Coona Conan restaurant near Icebridge, and he wanted to come and work at the Churchill Arms. And I thought, God, Thai. I thought, heavens, what's Thai? I had never tasted Thai food ever, never heard of it, I think. And there were two restaurants only in London at that time, I think. And I went down to the Coona Conan. Ben cooked some dishes, lovely. And I thought, he wants to come and work at the Churchill. But Thai, you know, it was so different to what the pub, old traditional pub. You really should have traditional, lovely menu at night to go. And I thought, God, what will happen? But I thought, hang on, this is a new part of the Churchill. We have the rest conservatory. We have the regional pub. We have all that going. But we have a new little part as well beginning to happen. And I thought, God, this could happen maybe. So I took a chance to take him on. And I did. God, it was the best thing that ever happened as well, because it was so different. It was so new. Suddenly, within a few months, it started to get busier and busier. The word had got out. My God, I was there in the kitchen. I was there in the conservatory serving the food. I was in the pub. The whole thing was beginning to really take off.
Yes, the sweet and sour and spicy flavours of Thai food were a hit and became a vital ingredient of the Churchill. The Thai food was one of the Churchill's hallmarks, telling a story, making a difference, and was really beginning to get the place noticed. What a good decision. And there's more. To lure customers in, a pub with curb appeal, with that external X factor, will always have the upper hand. And Jerry knew this, and he had a plan. And it was based on something from his childhood. Yes, flowers. Cue a chap who introduced himself to Jerry by saying,
I'm Ray. And I said, right, Ray. He said, I can do your plants 10 times better than what you have outside. You'd say that anyway. I said, if you're looking for a job. I said, Ray, you prove it to me now. I said, you do some plants here in front of the conservatory. do five or six. We chose five or six places. I said, and I'll see how good they are. And he did. And oh, they were fantastic. And I thought, God. I said, Ray, well, can you keep this going for around the rest of the pub next year? He did. And so that's where the flowers started. They were so magnificent, the first row. And then they were having an effect too. People were taking photographs of them. And then the second year, we said, Ray, can we put a few more maybe just up the next tier? And look at what happened. And I was breaking every budget that I was allowed to have, I think. But honest, everything was going in the right direction because it was having an effect on the business because people were noticing it outside and people were coming in.
Prince Charles, now King Charles, famously once shared he talked to his plants. And it looks like King Charles isn't the only plant talker.
Well, of course, the end of the night never was the end of the night because it was always people had gone. Yes, we cleaned up. We said goodbye night to the staff, wished them all upstairs to bed. I changed into my old Wellingtons and my old trousers and all that, my old gear. I had done my money, done my tills. Everything was fine. And I thought, no, my plants. I have to go and talk to my plants. And I put my music on, my Irish music on, out the conservatory, and water my plants every second night. And that would make an hour and a half, you know. And I had my wellies on. And what it used to mean, I used to feel like I'm down the fields at my old home where I grew up. I'm in my fields at the Glebe House where I had my most marvelous 15 years of my life that were so special to me. And I used to feel that coming in and throwing my wellies off at the Churchill at 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe, you know.
Do you know Jerry sold over 1 million pints of Guinness during his tenure at the Churchill? Here he tells us of a super bit of trademarked Jerry O'Brien theatre involving a plastic pint of Guinness.
And then the Guinness trick was lovely. I had this Guinness trick. I had this plastic pint of Guinness, you see. I had several of them, but I used to have one on the counter always. And you know how long you're pouring away your Guinness and you have to let it settle and put it up on the counter, let it settle. But I always had this plastic one, you know. And of course, people would be up waiting for their drinks and there we are. And I'd just go like that.
Tipping the plastic pint over.
Without looking, you don't let any kids fall over the counter. They're all blanchable. And they'd tell me off, and then they'd be, oh, and it created a lovely time atmosphere. Yeah, God. Yeah, well, you see, Elton, I mean, I know I was in the Churchill Arms. How English could be, you could be having running a pub called the Churchill Arms, and we're here with Fuller's in England. But I was always conscious of myself and where I came from. You know, and from Ireland, you know, and so on. I thought I never wanted to let that go, you know. And of course, I knew how, being Irish, you were expected to have to sell a good pint of Guinness. The Guinness pump used to be completely clean twice a week because I was always felt, well, look at, I'm Irish. I'm from Clare. You know, I'm Irish. I have to sell a good pint of Guinness. And people would expect it from you then when they got you. You're Irish. The Guinness must be good, like, you know. And of course, we always were very, very, train the staff to how to pour it, how to head settle, top it up nicely. And then and we did it that way. And of course, then people got to know that. And they loved having a pint of Guinness from you. But everyone would love the Guinness and the way we served it, the way we poured it and served it. And not just pouring a pint and handing it out. It was very special, the topping it up and then serving it up. So I think from that point of view, we got a lot of people wanted to drink Guinness and loved being served by us, by me, with Guinness. And of course, then, look at the sales.
Jerry sold over 1 million pints of Guinness during his tenure at the Churchill.
And St. Patrick's Day, God. We used to sell a week's Guinness on one day. I remember them days. My God. We had extra pumps today. We had 4 Guinness taps instead of 2. We had 4 Guinness taps put in for the bar that day, you know. And I always trained my staff to make sure they knew how to pour a pint of Guinness. They had way to settle and then top it up slowly and put it out. Yeah. So I think from that, Elton, it was nice, the pride we took in having that right as well. Because you didn't want to forget. You know, you don't forget like who you are or where you come from either. And you know how special Guinness is.
Feature Design is a tiny little, big award-winning design and print agency for the hospitality sector. Yes, Feature Design, tiny and little, but award-winningly big. Find them on featuredesign.co.uk. Email studio@featuredesign.co.uk. It's 01227 743 730. Feature Design, the hospitality sector design and print agency. Oh, did I mention they're award-winning? Yes, I did I? Sorry, just checking.
But there was something else Jerry wanted. He really wanted to do something, but he needed the support of his area manager, Una Moyer, with this one. The ladies' loo was underwhelming, to say the least, and Jerry wanted to change this. He wanted to give his female guests a better experience.
Then, of course, our loos were very important as well. And we always always felt that loos were so important, especially ladies. And then to find the loos that the weather were, and the compliments that we used to get, they used to come up. And, of course, they would tell more of their lady friends. Then their lady friends would tell more of their lady friends, and their boyfriends, and they would tell. And the loos became famous nearly, Una, you know. And then, of course, Una becoming our area manager was like the best thing that ever happened to me, I think. It really was, because Una was not just our area manager. She became so interested in what I wanted to do and the way we wanted the Churchill to be as well, you know. And everything that I thought of, Una agreed, and she backed me up wholeheartedly. Especially the loos were a huge, important thing to me. I was really, 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 I couldn't get that. That had to be special, you know.
So the chaps were happy with their loos. The ladies were very happy with their brand new loos. The pub was looking at its best, as they say in Ireland. The crack was good, and the music was there, being created by the bar staff. So happy fellas, happy girls, happy people. Well, you know what happens then. Let Jerry explain.
And then to find the loos that the weather were, and the compliments that we used to get, they used to come up. And of course, they would tell more of their lady friends. Then their lady friends would tell more of their lady friends, and their boyfriends, and they would tell. And the loos became famous, you know.
And famous people. Plenty of famous people have visited the Churchill. Actually, I must tell you, after we stopped recording on our way back to the tube station, Jerry remembered a story of a very tetchy Sinead O'Connor, Boris Johnson with his cycle clips on. But right now, he tells us a story about a national treasure, a former newsreader.
Angela Rippon was sitting at the bar, looking at us, waiting for her. See, she was having a takeaway one night. Oh, Angela, God, that's going back a bit now, but she was there, can you imagine? And then Bob Geldof, you know, the Irish, he used to come in. I remember he came in one night, and there was about six of them, and he went off with a huff, because when the place was packed, they could not get a table out the back. You know, Harrison Ford.
And TV Gardner.
Titchmarsh, Alan Titchmarsh. We had Prince Edward.
And Jerry asked if Prince Edward would come behind the bar and pull a pint of London Pride.
I wasn't supposed to ask anything like that, but I said to my staff, I told nobody in my staff, I said, look, lads, I'm going to ask him, will he come and pull a pint with me? And I said, when he comes in, I'll introduce you all to him, but you just step aside and we'll pull a pint. And of course that happened, and he wasn't supposed to do that at all. And they were killing me, I think, the security, but they could see everything was going lovely. Well, that was lovely, imagine. Prince Edward, behind the bar, we pulled a pint. And then this lady one day said to me, Jerry, I will bring Lady Soames to see you one day. I said, Lady Soames, Churchill's youngest daughter, Mary Soames. And I said, what? I said, no. I said, my God. And I got, what? I couldn't get over it. She said, I will. Because she said, look at what you do. She knows what you do for Churchill night. She said, because I do, you know, Churchill. So I said, she rang. What day? And I said, my God. She said, rang the stage. Jerry, she said, she's here. What's the best time to call? I said, my God. I said, the afternoon then. I said, because it will be a bit quieter, maybe between 3 and 5. I said, we'll have time to have a chat. And I said, my God. So we arranged the two tables together. And I remember thinking, telling the staff, now I told no one, the customers, I didn't want people to be piling in and maybe on top of her. I thought, I know, she's coming to see me. I want to have my time to see her. Surely there'll be people around anyway to see her and when she's here. But it was such a special thing. I just wanted my own time with her. You know, can you imagine this now, you know? I said, the afternoon, we'll have tea and cakes, perhaps, after showing her the pub, you know, and so on and so on and so on. So I had them in the lovely cakes I got from Sally Clark in the fridge, and I had the tables laid up, and I said, right, I'm going to put a bottle of Paul Roger, Churchill's favourite champagne, into the bucket. Just there, I said, come on, just do that, and have glasses. I'd never thought for a minute that we'd ever even open the bottle or touch it. Anyway, then I had all that set up anyway. So then she came. Of course, I was in and out all that day for an hour beforehand. I mean, sweeping up outside the doors, making sure that there were no leaves or anything on the pavement, you know, because I thought, my God, I have to play. So then I went out once, and there she was coming down the side street along with her friend from that lived next door on the street next door. Lady Soames, I mean, and she had her hair like the Queen, you know, the Queen style, you know, and she was so beautiful. And I was nervous now because, I mean, you're meeting Lady Soames, Churchill's daughter, I mean, God. And as well as that, something else there was, but I'll come to that now in a second. But Jerry, she said, outside, she said, I've been passing here for so long. She said, I just want to say how amazing the flowers are. I always stop to look, or almost stop, she said, to look, but I can't ever, I never was able to come in. And she said, you know, she said, and I want to thank you for what you did for my father. Imagine that, you know. Oh, God, you know, because it all came back to me then, you know, with Churchill Night, you know, the big effort we were doing for Churchill Night. It was, really, you know, and every day we were, he was always mentioned, wasn't he? We had lots of pictures and frames of him around the place. So we came around the rest of the pub, all the stuff she was looking at. And then we came to lots of other pictures that we came around then to chamber, to the lovely lounge area. And I said, by the way, all the prime ministers are there, you know. And I said, look, there he's there in the centre. He's keeping an eye on us at all time. I said, he's looking, keeping an eye. So I said, we have to behave ourselves, you know, like that. But I said, Lady Soames, this lovely picture up here. Look at this. There's your father, I said. He has his hat on his stick. Oh, she said. And I said to her, I often wonder, who would you know, I said, who is this person beside him? And she said, Jerry, that's me, she said. And I said, what? I said, what? I was knocked out. Can you imagine? I said, the amount of people and times that I look, that want to know who that person is. I said, Mary, Lady Soames, I can't believe it. And I mean, can you imagine? But you see, it was so much going on. I never asked her. I would have loved to, she would have signed it for me. I'm sure she would. But anyway, we continued out the back in the flans, and I gave her the story of the whole place then, you know, what happened. And she said again, Jerry, I thank you what you do for my father. She said, I know you do it every year. And she said, I would love to come one day. I said, Lady Soames. And I was in my, then time was coming, it was 5 o'clock, 5:30. A lot of people coming in. People were getting to know who it was, and they were coming over then asking, you know, all to say, shake her hand and all. That was lovely and all that. But then 6 o'clock, she was had time to leave, you know. So I remember I had got a lovely little bouquet of flowers, you know, and so on to give her on the way out. You know, I had that got. And then I asked her, I had a staff told to have a camera ready just in case she might agree to a photograph. And I didn't know whether she would or not. But I said to Lady Soames, I said, I'm still in a trance looking at you, talking to you. I said, it's just, you know, you don't know what it means to me. I said, is any chance of a photograph? Of course, sir, she said, come on, let's come and sit in here. They were in the side, I was sitting out the front. So I sat in beside her, and she had hands on her table, and there we are, with the bust of Churchill as well on the table. Yes, I had the bust of Churchill on the table and the champagne. Oh, yeah, by the way, sorry. When we sat down, I said, Lady Soames, would you like, you know, tea? I said, we have tea, cakes, what do we have? But I said, also, do you know whose favourite this was? Oh, my father, she said, my father's favourite. I said, would you like a glass? She said, oh, Jerry, I'd love a glass. Oh, I said, my God, I couldn't believe it. So it was all an ice, everything like that. So I had the 3 glasses. I opened the bottle, poured it out. We drank the whole bottle of champagne in that 2.5 hours, the three of us. Can you imagine that was that? You know, I kept that empty bottle back, and I have it back at my house at home. You know, the bottle that Lady Soames drank at the Churchill, I have that at home. So imagine that. And then, sold it by the glass. We were selling thousands of it by the glass. And the people, I mean, couples sometimes, oh, I'll have a glass of Churchill's favourite champagne, Paul Roger.
Your professionally recorded message will be played here. You will be given scriptwriting guidance, and to bring your ad to life, it can feature sound effects like this. Or this. Or this. Or even this. Your message in there is.
And with the support of his Fuller's area manager, Jerry was about to really hit the jackpot and be truly accepted by the local community.
And then, of course, the support I was getting from, well, Una, from Fuller's, like, Una was like, she was our boss, she was our area manager. We still had our things to answer for, but she was like a mother to me as well in one way, you know, because she, you know, Una got the feel for the Churchill that I had as well, I think. All the events we did, you know, Una got behind them with me as well. You know, she just didn't let me say get on with it and that, but she did all the paperwork for it. And then our street parties. I mean, that was such a major thing the first time. We had to get street permission. And of course, I said to myself, I know a certain amount of people living in our street, but I don't know them all. to 35 houses. I remember going up one side, down the other, counting all the doors, 34 or 5 doors, and I got 35 letters done and envelopes and signed by me and asking them, would they mind at all? Could we have a portion of the street for a certain length of time? You're all invited to our party. And of course, Then we had decorations. We had the street furniture and the bunting flags and the food and the atmosphere of the street party. And of course, that brought the local residents of that street more and more involved with us. We were asking their permission. We were bringing them into the Churchill. They were part of what was happening. The one who backed us all and was there every event, every day, the whole day, from morning till night. Imagine that. Giving up her home life, giving up everything. And that was very special. And then the horses from the brewery, which came along. I mean, my God, you know. And there was, and you know, afterwards, what that meant to me, it brought me in. I felt, God, the locals know me so well now. I know them so well. We're part of that. There was a huge local feeling and commitment to the Churchill from everybody. I think that did something to me. That from then on, it brought the Churchill, not just there for people like, you know, but for our local people, especially that street, you know, and the streets beside it as well. Put the icing on the cake, I think, you know, as far as my feeling to the Churchill, you know, and the effect it was having, and that we had suddenly... We had got that support and that thing that was going to be there forever, I thought, you know, and so on. It was a great feeling, you know, for all the years of work beforehand and all the tough times as well. Because, I mean, running a pub is not an easy job. This commitment is physically demanding.
But trouble was looming. Was one vital ingredient of the Churchill about to collapse? Find out in part 3 of Ordinary to Extraordinary.
Feature Design is a tiny little, big award-winning design and print agency for the hospitality sector. Yes, Feature Design, tiny and little, but award-winningly big. Find them on featuredesign.co.uk. Email studio@featuredesign.co.uk. It's 01227 743 730. Feature Design. The Hospitality Sector Design and Print Agency. Oh, did I mention they're award-winning? Yes, I did I? Sorry, just checking.
This is part 3 of From Ordinary to Extraordinary, charting the story of how one Gerard Daniel O'Brien, that's Jerry to you and I, turned the Churchill Pub in Notting Hill, London, from something quite ordinary into something quite extraordinary. Some may find part 3 upsetting, so please do switch off now if you find open conversation around suicidal ideation triggers you. But if you do decide to listen, it is a lovely, really happy ending.
All the events were happening. We were doing, as I say, our lovely events. The food was going fiercely well and all that. And of course, then one day, Ben,
the Thai head chef,
came to me and said, Jerry, I've got to... bad news to you, I've got an offer of a restaurant. And he had to leave. I thought it was going to crash. I thought the whole thing was going to fall back.
But it turned out Ben actually had a solution.
He said, I have a couple of people that I know. He said, they're very, very, very good cooks and they would be the right people to be here. And he told me the name. His name was Pau and her husband. So they came to see me and thank God they took the job. And they're there to this day. They had the franchise and they were, and of course they having the franchise, we decided to do that. It was a great incentive for them, a little bit more extra incentive to stay on, to give it their best, to make sure that their food was the best, and it suited what I wanted the pub to be as well. But we needed both to work. We didn't want one without the other. And of course they're there today. What a wonderful time it has been for Pau and her husband. And her team of people as well, and they're there to this day, which is wonderful, you know. And that was a huge moment as well. It continued on where we were, on the way we were going, it continued on. And then getting to know the Thais was fabulous as well for me. And they are such smashing people, and the language, my God, and the fun we used to have with them, and trying to learn the words and trying to learn some language. But they were lovely, and people loved them as well, and so on. And then Thailand, we talked about Thailand and so on. People were saying, oh, we've gone to Thailand, we've been to Thailand, and there was Thailand was in the Churchill. So, and for the Thai people and the staff, they were treated so well as well by the customers and that, and they made them feel good as well. And they could see that their business was growing as well. They could see how happy I was, and that we all were. And it was a marvellous story, you know. And people used to say to me, Thai, Irish. I used to say, I'm Thai-ish, you know. But they said, how does this work? Churchill, Irish, Thai. I said, lovely mixture. And that's what we were all about, a mixture of everybody and everything. My God, I honestly, I can't believe sometimes, you know, what it became, the Churchill. And it became a place for everyone to come, you know. What age group. Oh, God. You know, it was wonderful.
And the Churchill was winning awards, lots of them. The Evening Standard, Pub of the Year, the Time Out, People's Choice, all sorts. But of all the awards he received, there was one that stood out more than any other. The Fuller's Pub of the Year.
So much has happened at the Churchill that the awards were kind of, it was a part of what was happening. I mean, it's the recognition that I got from Fuller's all those early years as well, that, you know, appreciated what I had been doing with the pub since I got it. In those early years, they're Pub of the Year. Imagine that. I mean, and to be out at the meetings and to be and given those plaques, you know, and then to bring them back to the pub and to show my customers and show the staff. They said, look at what we've awarded, and to be able to put them up on the wall. I mean, God. And anyone that came to the pub after that, new people are shown. People wanted me to show them around the pub. They'd say, show me around. Of course I would. You know, and they would come to those lovely plaques because they all were in the pub. I never had anything in my room upstairs because downstairs was my front room, if you know what I mean, the pub. And they were on the pub and I'd be telling them, Fuller's Pub of the Year. They said, what did this happen? You know, a customer would say, I said, look, they're all there, those lovely plaques. And you know, that would give you the drive to, you were appreciated. You were appreciated, actually, you know, by what you were doing. And it would keep you, and then would drive on, you know, to keep going. It was really special. I mean, Fuller's and the family and the people they were, you know, the way they helped you all the way.
It's so apparent now, isn't it? People are so hugely important to Jerry. And the bonds he makes with his staff are strong. So strong, the children of some of his former staff would make the journey to the Churchill to find him.
And you know, there were some occasions when one girl came to me one day and she said, Jerry, she said, my mother worked for you. And I said, what? I said, your mother? What, you or your mother? No, she said, my mother. And I, over the years, you know, and she'd ring up her mother in South Africa, one occasion, South Africa. Her mother worked for me for how many months and she had gone back, got married, there was her children, and her daughter had come to the Churchill. I mean, I said, how could all that happen? And I said, I mean, that, you know, to me, the pub was everything to me, you know. I thought, her family, my God, all this amazing. I mean, oh, wasn't that lovely, glorious?
Yes, it is glorious. And there's more on the subject of staff. Remember Jerry sharing his fond memories of how Mr. Tierney had given him not only a chance and a job, but also a home. In a highly emotional segment, Jerry recalls how he looked after his staff.
Of course, what I loved with my staff was that I was allowed to have them living in. And that was hugely important to me because we created a family scene behind the scenes, if we know, and so on. So I advertised for staff, we're living in accommodation. And that's the way it started for me going back all those years ago in the Prince Regent. And I know what that meant behind the scenes. And of course, all the staff coming in, having their accommodation, that was their home as well as their job, as well as everything. And then I used to love sitting down with them on Saturday night when we finished the week, and we'd sit down over by the fireplace. I'd buy them a drink and thank them for the week's work, you know. And I used to cook for them as well, you know. It was lovely. And I'd bring out little bits and pieces and we'd sit for an hour, maybe Saturday night, you know, because we didn't have to get up for an hour later on Sunday morning because we opened at 10, 12, so they wouldn't have to start until 10 o'clock. They'd start at 9 other mornings. And that was hugely important to me myself. They were my family kind of thing, you know. And of course, obviously, from a business point of view, they were happy. Then being happy behind the counter, happy staff, they were happy, the customers. They gave more than they ever probably were meant to, maybe, as well, you know. And then, of course, regular customers used to get to know how I looked after them. And they would tell the customers, oh, Jerry cooked this, sir, and whatever have you, you know, and we had this lovely, lovely party the other night. And the locals and regulars got to know that. And then they would tell new staff coming in, oh, wait till you hear, Jerry will be looking after you this way or that way. And, of course, it meant staff stayed longer than they probably would have done, you know, and they enjoyed it so much there as well. And then I used to enjoy having them sit around the table with me at the end of the Saturday night, a busy week, you know. And then their birthdays, I always wanted to know when their birthdays were, and I'd give them that day off and have a nice little cake outside their door in the morning, leave it when they got up, you know. And, you know, it was, oh, God, it was fantastic. And Easter time, I'd have a lovely big Easter egg and a card outside their door in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, I put them outside their door, so when they woke up, they come out, oh, God, we have our, you know, and oh, those things that I just did. You wouldn't think secondly about it, but just family kind of thing, you know. And Christmas, of course, Christmas night, oh, we'd shut, the only time of the year we shut was Christmas night, after 3 o'clock. And then, of course, that was a Christmas staff party for me. I'd sit them all day up, or they all went up to change and left them up there for an hour. I laid up all the tables and set up the whole thing, and I had all my cooking going on in the kitchen, and we had our lovely Christmas night. Oh, it was heaven. And then maybe they'd go away after maybe 11, 12 o'clock. They'd go back up and I'd clean up. Then I used to go out and walk down Kensington Church Street, down one to Kensington High Street, walk up the other side for my Christmas walk, if you'd not called it that. And then I'd go in, I'd switch the lights on and come out and walk over across the road, and one look up at them on Christmas night. Oh, God. Oh.
And that is the story of how Jerry O'Brien turned something ordinary into something extraordinary. The Churchill was now a world-famous pub. The Churchill chapter was closing for Jerry. We know how endings have impacted on Jerry, possibly more than he knows. The sudden move from the country tranquility of Glebe House to Ennis, the heavy-handed ending at the Drayton Arms as a bigger company took over. And it was now time for Jerry to leave the Churchill. I asked him about how he found the ending. He paused.
That's not very easy to talk about, Elton.
And I must warn you, if you're triggered by the conversations about suicide ideation, please stop listening.
The emotion of it didn't hit me then, because I was so taken up with finishing up and making everything spot on, everything right for who was taking over, James, and I wanted everything to be right. So I was taken up with all that and so on, and sorting out a few bits to send home and so on and all that. But it only hit me a few days when I got home. Suddenly, it suddenly hit me. Wow. What have I left? What now? What have I left behind? What have I left? And I think what saved me was that I started looking back at the fabulous times that I had. But also, I was blaming myself a little bit and not thinking about it a bit more, maybe, or planning it a bit more, because I suddenly went from there to there with nothing. Nothing to happen. Come down the stairs in the morning and nothing. You open the door at 11 o'clock. I used to open the door, my front door, at 11 o'clock for several weeks and months. Just part of what I used to do at the church. Nobody would come in, obviously, you know. Things like 11 o'clock at night, I used to look at my watch and think, my God, you know, we have a bell. I have a bell in the kitchen. I'd go out and give it a little tinkle. I really mean that. Isn't that crazy when you think of it? But just things like that, you know. But then I didn't know too many people there, because it wasn't my home, really. It was my mother's home, Ennis. But I bought the house there at that time, going back, luckily that I did. And I had that place to go to. Well, I knew some people. But then the more people I talked to, that pub. I bring the pub up because I had to. And all the people, the cameras were out, their phones were out. There it is, there's the pub. I didn't realise how well the pub was known, even at home, you know, because obviously people had been to the pub as well, but it was all on their phones. People straight away, the church, oh, that pub with the flowers. So I knew that something great had happened for my life, you know, but that kept me going, really, but because there were some terrible times when I then to suddenly realise it's gone. It's gone, you know. You'll never have that again. I mean, that's... I don't know. I can't explain how bad that felt. But I was as low as anyone could get. I think... I don't know what saved me from doing something silly, you know. But of course, it was so good. It was so magnificent for so many reasons. The Churchill, for so many, my whole life. And, you know, I would have liked to have died in the Churchill. And I would like to be buried in the cellar. You know, that's how I feel. Because the cellar in the Churchill was the engine room of the pub as well, as you know, with everything happening beer-wise and all that coming up from the cellar. And I would love to be buried there. But that's how I feel today, still.
But Jerry was about to start the slow process of picking himself up and dusting himself down. And here's how he did it. And although he was no longer working for Fuller's, Fuller supported him throughout.
But thank God, I began to kind of come to terms slowly, and then I looked at my house, and I began to not like it too much in the beginning because I had no feeling for it, because my feeling was somewhere else, you know, as I'm talking about. And then I started doing something, a few things with the house, got an extension to my front room, and then. Once that started, I was doing things. I was doing something with the place, but there was no love for the house for a while, you know, for a couple of years. And I think when lockdown came, I was happiest I was, because I think I didn't want to speak to anyone, because everyone I spoke to, the Churchill was the topic, a point, and it brought back all those beautiful, amazing memories. And then it also brought back that was gone, in one sense, you know, and that you'd never have that again. And that was desperate. It still is, to be honest. You know, from time to time, it hits me. But I got through that stage of lockdown without having to meet people and to talk about it and to stir it all up again. It kind of lifted, gave it time to rest and to lay, to let it lie and to think about, hang on, let's think about how lucky you were, how grateful you must be, how thankful. And I pray to God every night, you know. And I talk about that how lucky I was and how grateful I have to be to have the pub like the Churchill and to what happened for me there and the help I got from everyone and the respect I got from everyone to make it the marvelous 33 years that they were. And so much that I started enjoying thinking about it from that point of view and beginning to feel better in myself. And then the house started to change a bit without me realising it. The extension got done, but I wasn't really in love with it, if you know what I mean. But now, thank God, I'm beginning to look at my house now and liking it and talking to it, and a smile comes to my face when I see what I've done with it, you know. And I have my front room now. People that have visited me, Owen that came all the way from Australia to visit me, it's like the Churchill Arms. He said to me, Jerry, this is the Churchill. I walk in. I have lovely old barrels, all decorated, and Churchill Arms, Kensington. I have another one, Fuller's Brewery, so on and all that. I have a lovely collection on one side of the house, all donated to Winston Churchill, you know. Because it was so part of books and things like that. And then my old home, I have a beautiful, lovely, lovely painting of my old home and picture right over the fireplace. And that's the memories for that. So I'm saying how lucky I have been, the greatest 15 years I could ever imagine to have, first of all. Then my lovely story here in London. And how lucky I was to get the Churchill and what happened there for me. So I have then 40-50 odd years of my life to be so thankful for, and thank God now I'm beginning to just this last year, really, it's taken 5 years to come to terms, you know, with all that, because you won't have that again. I can never have that again. I know that, but the memories are fantastic and fabulous, and in my wildest dreams, if I ever was told that that was going to happen, you could not believe it. You couldn't imagine it happening. And it did happen, you know. So I'm saying, come on. And I do pray every night a little bit and thank God for all that happened to me. And now I'm beginning to realize that, look, you couldn't keep going the way you were. The demands of the pub, of Churchill, were so that I couldn't keep doing that. So I would have had to stop. I would have. But my trouble was I never thought that day would ever come, you know. And then suddenly it did come. And then the after effects of that for a while. Oh, heavens, I can't. But then the greatest thing was I joined this club at home, a retirement club for retired businessmen. And so many of them, there's about 65 members now. We meet every Tuesday at home, in the hotel at home. And so many of them know, well, they all know the Churchill Arms. The feeling is still there. I will always, of course, be in the Churchill, you know, because that's such a special place. So it was lovely. So it's now, I've gone full circle, I think. I've come to terms now that I had the best years that anyone could ever have wished for, and I could never have believed would happen. And I'm grateful and thankful for that, and the people that I'm still in touch with, and right, like now, you know, and so on. It's lovely, and you know, I'm sitting here with you, Elton, and it's like we were talking. We were 30 years ago. You know, it's when I said it's gone from one since a point of view, from running the pub. You're not running it anymore. But it's not really gone in another way. It's the context I still have, the friendships I still have. And that to me is I have to be fierce grateful for that, you know, because that to me will keep me going, you know. And so I'm very thankful for that still. To be going, to be ongoing, and to have those connections and those friendships and and so on, and to meet up with you, be able to talk about the great times, and that to me, I couldn't expect any more, I couldn't wish for any more, and there's nothing more that I would wish for, except if I was 30 years younger and start again at the Churchill Arms.
I asked if he would do it again.
I would, and I would do it all again. So I have to be. I know I'm a bit emotional, but. It's been emotional and happy as well, you know, from that point of view. There's nothing wrong with that, is there, really? Because that means so much, doesn't it, you know? So I should be really smiling every day now. And you know what? I am now smiling every day. Because I come down to my house now and I look at my house and I'm looking at my Churchill Arms bits and pieces, and it's similar to the feeling that you have in the lounge at the Churchill.
Our time with Gerry is coming to a close now. It was an extraordinary conversation of peaks and troughs, wasn't it? Dark and shade and happiness and sadness from an extraordinary man who turned something ordinary into something extraordinary.
So, Gerry O'Brien, thank you very much indeed. Shake my hand.
Thank you, Elton.
Give me a hug.
Oh, stop. Oh, God.
Thanks, Gerry.
I mean, as I say, I left the Churchill that day, but I still haven't left in one way, have I? Because today as well, you know, it's a story that's continuing with me. Isn't it lovely, isn't it?